I'd like to welcome you this morning to the Second Court of Appeals. Thank you for being here. Before we begin, I want to introduce the panel to you. To my left is Justice Wade Birdwell. To my right is Justice Elizabeth Kerr, and I'm Bonnie Setter, the Chief Justice of the Court. It's my understanding that the attorneys are ready to begin, but before you begin, will I have the please have the clerk call the case.
Chief Justice Sutterth, members of the panel, and may it please the court. My name is Niles Illick, and I represent the appellant, Darren Rush. We have five issues on appeal today, and that is a lot for an oral argument, and I do plan to touch on all of them, but I think quite a few of them can be disposed very quickly. I am going to approach them in the order in which they were presented in our opening brief. In our first argument, we contend that the district court erred when it admitted evidence of value through State's Exhibit 3. The state indicted appellant for theft of property between $30,000 and $150,000. A necessary component of this was to show valuation. Here, evidence of valuation came through Larry Clapp in State's Exhibit 3. This issue concerns the objection to State's Exhibit 3. Now, I think I have to concede at the beginning that opposing counsel is correct that trial counsel did not secure a running objection, and he did not continue to object to this when Mr. Clapp read from State Exhibit 3.
Well, let me ask you, that may very well be true, but State's Exhibit 3 doesn't label any of those numbers fair market value or anything like that, and I think that Mr. Clapp basically ended up testifying that he had no idea what those numbers were based on, right?
That's exactly right, Justice Kerr. And I think that goes to some of our later issues that we're going to discuss here in the sufficiency of the evidence and the question of the issue of the failure to define the term value under 31.08 of the Penal Code in the jury charge.
He did, however, testify that the CPA from whom he obtained the document had made the evaluation for purposes of taxes. Do we know what type of taxes we're talking about? Were these federal taxes and therefore dealing with depreciation, or were they state tax property taxes in terms of the state imposing a tax based upon some type of value of the property?
Justice Birdwell, there is discussion, and I don't have the citation in my head, about the taxation, and I believe it's cited in the brief, but I don't think that Clapp himself clarified that, and I don't think he knew the answer to it. He said,
The reason I ask is if, for example, it is for purposes of taxes with regard to imposed by the state, then we would have a state statute that would tell us what the underlying value is supposed to be for purposes of the particular tax that was involved. There's a reason. He did testify there's a reason why the CPA was doing it. It was for purposes of taxes.
Right.
And therefore, if in fact there was some clarification of what taxes were involved, that would seem to maybe be able to give us some information with regard to that. But I don't recall that the state argued that.
Justice Birdwell, I do not believe that the specific tax was identified. I think that Mr. Clapp was very clear that he didn't know what this number came from, where it came from. It was handed to him by the owner of the company on the morning of testimony, and he was resoundingly clear that he just was kind of there reporting the number that was given to him that morning. So I don't think we can say with certainty what Clapp's basis or what the number basis was. But what I wanted to say here, and I think this goes back to Justice Kerr's point very quickly, is that we have a waiver problem here, and I am willing to concede that on our first issue. but it's important that we don't concede this issue, and it's important that we don't that we continue to press this issue, because one of the issues that this court is going to have to address ultimately is our claim of ineffective assistance of counsel with this very strange motion for new trial. And when we look at that, one of the issues that's been raised is the totality of the representation. And I think that we can see with this failure to get a running objection, failure to continue to object, that we have problems with that representation, and I will return to that. But going to Justice Kerr's point, really, and turning to my second argument, I think we have a problem with the jury charge, and I think the state has somewhat reluctantly conceded that there is a deficiency in the jury charge from the failure to define the word value as that is defined under 31.08 of the Penal Code, I think 31.08. Again, this was not objected to. It was not an issue that was raised at trial. And again, I think that goes to the totality of the representation. But unlike our first issue, as this court is aware, we don't have an argument of waiver here. We just have an argument of we have to show egregious harm under Almanza. So assuming that the state has, in fact, conceded that there's harm, I think we can turn to the harm analysis in Almanza and look to those four prongs. Now, when we look at the first and second prong, the prong of the totality of the jury charge and the evidence are really kind of mixed up in my mind, and they go together a lot. When we look at the jury charge, to me, the most important question in the jury charge was the question of value. When we look at the evidence in this case, I don't think there is a whole lot of evidence that the man hiding behind the trash can with money in his pocket on the cell phone was not the person who committed this crime. The jury had to decide, though, number one, did he commit the crime? And I think the evidence probably supports that. And number two, if he did support the crime, what was the value of the stolen property? And that's where we get into the difficulty. Now, I think the state will get up here and will argue to you that the term value is so self-apparent and so readily understood and must sort of necessarily mean fair market value that there was no reason for the legislature to even go and define the term. But I think that's the wrong argument. Value can mean a lot of things, as we've argued on our brief. It can mean fair market value. It can mean replacement value, both of which are referenced in the Penal Code. It can mean sentimental value. It can mean a whole bunch of other things. That's why it was so important to define it in the jury charge.
But it wasn't argued that way.
Excuse me?
The attorneys didn't argue it that way.
Go ahead, please.
During final argument, it wasn't argued that it was sentimental or anything like that. It was argued as fair market value.
Chief Justice Sutterth, I would argue that it was argued as value. And value is an important distinction between replacement value and fair market value. And that distinction is important.
So they didn't use the phrase fair market value in final argument?
Fair market value, I think, is used once or twice, but predominantly the use of the word is value without fair market attached to it. And when we look at the Penal Code definition in 31.08, it doesn't limit it simply to fair market value. It says fair market value, or if that can't be determined, the replacement cost in a reasonable amount of time. So it could be fair market value. Value could be defined as fair market value in the Penal Code, or it could be defined as the reasonable replacement cost. Now, this issue becomes more complicated because we have a lessor-lessee relationship. Now, everyone on this panel, opposing counsel and myself, is aware of the definition of 1.07A35A that defines an owner of property. We all know that it's the person with the greater right to the possession of the property than it is the bad actor. But that was not included in the jury charge. That definition is not in the jury charge. I think it should have been, but it isn't there. So we have a question about a lessor-lessee relationship without a definition of value and how this jury was supposed to determine it. And when we look at the evidence, when we look at the charge, I think we have real difficulty. Now, opposing counsel has cited to a few cases, Bullock, Landrum, Yohanian, I think Bullock is probably their most persuasive case because it also involves a lease. It involves a lease of a Penske truck, I think, and it was a value of about $85,000. There was no real dispute about value, no real uncertainty. But when we look at State's Exhibit 3, it shows that these vehicles were leased to Falls Concrete, LLC, owned by Northwest Materials, LLC, and the indictment had to show a loss to ABC Rentals. Now, how was the jury supposed to figure out the value of this to Falls Concrete, LLC? I think the evidence is enough to say that Falls Concrete, LLC, and ABC Rentals were the same entities, but how was the jury supposed to find that to a person who's leased these? Is that the value of the vehicles? Is that the value of the lost work? And if so, how much was the lost work? I don't know how much lost work is. There's no evidence of that in here. There's no evidence, indeed, that there was lost work. So I think when we look at the first and second prongs and the failure to define value, we have a lot of problems. Those problems become more severe when we look to the third prong of Almanza, and that is the arguments of counsel. Now, when we look to the arguments of counsel, I think this is where we get into the equipment that was not in the trucks. There were the trucks, the testimonies, the trucks come and go. They pick up some equipment that's sitting on the ground near them. And that equipment, I think, is valued at around $20,000. That was never in the indictment. That was not part of the indictment. I think equipment in the trucks would be part of the indictment. The trucks themselves would be part of the indictment, but the argument from counsel that the equipment that the trucks picked up that was just sitting next to them valued at about $20,000, which almost gets us to the threshold of $30,000, shouldn't have been there. And it was error for counsel to argue that. Oh, my gosh, I am running out of time, and that's my own fault here because you haven't asked that many questions. But I do want to turn to our fourth issue, and that's IAC. I know how hard IAC is. I know that it's nearly impossible to win that on direct appeal. We haven't given the trial attorney an opportunity to explain his effort.
Well, I'll shortcut your argument by asking you, I mean, I don't have any trouble with the idea that filing a motion for a new trial that's clearly in a wrong case, I just can't conceive of a possible reason for doing that. My question is really, what is the remedy that we could provide at this point for that? I mean, if we say, okay, go back and file another motion for a new trial, wouldn't that just be the same arguments that you're making to us today?
I think, Justice Kerr, that is the hard question. That number one, I think it's fairly easy to see that, but I think the remedy has to be that we go back and get to file a fair motion for new trial. We get to have the district court hear that motion for new trial, and if that comes out against us, we get to appeal the denial of that motion for new trial to this court. And I don't think it's an entirely new trial. I don't think that's right. I don't think it's a new sentencing. The only remedy would be an entirely new motion for new trial proceeding. Now, I think it's really easy to see deficiency here. Prejudice, I think, is almost as easy to see here because we have the deficiency in the jury charge. So there was a basis to file a motion for a new trial. That motion for a new trial would have been filed on the deficiencies in the jury charge. Now, very quickly, turning to our last claim of ineffective assistance of counsel, the failure to object to the confrontation clause. I don't think we get there on that argument. I think probably we cannot prevail on that argument without going back and talking to counsel, filing a motion for a new trial and asking counsel about his decision not to do that. But I do think it's important to see those deficiencies because counsel has argued that when we evaluate the overall performance, as we must in a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel, the trial counsel did a really good job. But I think when we look at what trial counsel did, it's fairly clear that he didn't do a fairly good job. He didn't secure the running objection. He didn't object when Clapp read from State's Exhibit 3, he didn't request the value instruction, something he should have been familiar with going into the jury charge. He failed to file an appropriate motion for a new trial, and he really blew the conference.
Was there, and maybe I'm showing my ignorance about values, depreciated value, fair market value, and all of that, but trial counsel asked Mr. Clapp at one point, and Clapp agreed that when he was talking about values, and you're talking about taxes, you're talking about a depreciated value. Is there anything from this record or from the law by which we can conclude that depreciated value has any relationship to fair market value? Are the two synonymous?
Justice Kerr, I don't think we can say that depreciated value and fair market, and I see that I've gone over my time, may I? Fair market value are the same. And I don't have a legal answer for you on that, but I recognize that, you know, the taxable value of my car is different than what I pay every year to get my little sticker is different than what I would sell the car for. And so I'm answering really from the worst possible position, and that is my own personal experience. But I don't have a legal answer to that.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, thank you.
May it please the court. Counsel, I'm Bryce Perry and I represent the state. This appeal arises from Darren Rush's theft of three pickup trucks and a flatbed trailer. The evidence was that the theft occurred in May 2018 and it concerned a 2016 four-door GMC, so a truck that was bought only 2 years before the theft, for $42,000. And the testimony was that that truck was virtually new and did not have much use at all. That's from volume 3, page 24 of the record. It also concerned a four-year-old Toyota truck that was bought for approximately $24,000 and had been in excellent condition. A third pickup truck that was bought in 2003 and a 2016 trailer that was bought in May 2016 for $4,600 and change.
Did Mr. Clapp testify to those numbers from personal knowledge, or was he testifying to those numbers based upon State's Exhibit number 3?
Those numbers of the purchase prices of those trucks at the time they were purchased come from State's Exhibit number 3.
Okay.
But, Your Honor, with respect.
My question is, looking at page 29 of the Rush brief, we've got State's Exhibit 3, and we have testimony from Mr. Clapp that this is that the CPA does evaluations for purposes of taxes, but I didn't hear any testimony, I didn't read any testimony that these were the only four pieces of equipment, four vehicles that were owned by Northwest Materials and leased by Falls Concrete. In fact, I seem to recall that Mr. Clapp testified there were quite a few other vehicles still on the lot, but he noticed that these four were gone. So why should we not conclude that a document that is purportedly for tax purposes with regard to the business, records exception, why should we conclude that it is, in fact, a business record when it doesn't have any of the other vehicles that were on the lot there, period, end of story?
Your Honor,
it looks like it was made for the litigation.
The answer to that question, Your Honor, is that was the testimony of Mr. Clapp. When he was asked about the requirements of the business records exception, he was asked whether the document was kept in the ordinary course of business, whether it was a regular practice operation, and he answered.
And those were leading questions, and he answered yes to all of those questions, and that establishes technically the business records. But I'm looking at the document that came in, and I'm looking at the other testimony that came in with regard to how it was created and why it was created, which seems to contradict exactly all of those things.
And I think, Your Honor, the trial court was entitled to take him at his word as he's testifying about those requirements of the business record exception. And during that exchange, when he's testifying about those things. There was knowledge about whether he was qualified to talk about whether those were proper business records and whether when they were made. And his testimony was that they were made at the time of the yearly tax preparation.
So if somebody testifies the moon is made of cheese and there's no objection to that, we're to take that as something that the trial court can credibly find?
Your Honor, I don't think that this the answer to your question is no.
That was rhetorical.
I think the answer to your question is no in that circumstance, but this circumstance is different. He was asked questions particularly related, were answered affirmatively, and there was no request by the other side to take him under a dire and
Let's assume that States Exhibit 3 is a pristine, admissible, wonderful document. I still don't see anything on Exhibit 3 that talks about fair market value, which is what 31.08 requires for the theft statute, right?
Your Honor, I think that the exhibit does not talk about fair market value, but I don't. I have a couple of responses to that question. The first one is that question that you asked opposing counsel. The testimony in this case was that those values reflected depreciable value. And under the case law, depreciable value, when the jury learns about a purchase price of an item and then learns about the fact that the value that the jury is learning of reflects depreciation, that is a testimony regarding fair market value. And I would point the court to a case called McGee versus State. It's 715 Southwest 2nd, 838 at pages 839 and 40. It's a Texap Houston 14th District Court of Appeals case from 1986. And in that case, on purchase price minus depreciation. And
but Mr. Clapp wasn't the owner of this property.
Your Honor, that argument has been made by the appellant in this case, but under the penal code, he was the owner of the property. There was testimony in this case that he wasn't the owner in terms of definition of owner under Section 1.07 of the penal code is someone who has a greater right to possession of property than the actor.
Was she the owner of Northwest Materials?
She was the owner of the
That's not the company owning.
And even so, Your Honor, that definition of owner encompasses 45 of the reporter's record that he was the person in charge of allowing people to take or not take and drive or not drive. Penal Code's definition of owner, the owner of the property, because he had a greater right to possession than Mr.
Okay, Rush so did. His testimony is that he didn't personally get this document until it was handed to him by the owner of the leasing company, okay? So even if you're doing a chain of custody, that's demonstrating that this is not a document kept in the ordinary course of business of the leasing company.
Your Honor, I believe his testimony was that his wife, the owner of False Concrete, had given him the document to bring to court
right,
that morning.
Right, and we've established that she's not the owner of Northwest Materials.
She's right. She's
it's the owner is the tax liability, not the lessee.
Well, his testimony, though, was that I may be miscomprehending the court's question, but his testimony was that the False Concrete, the business that was included in the indictment as the owner of the property, kept those documents in the ordinary course of business, and it was False Concrete's regular practice to keep them. So I think that testimony establishes all the requisites of who owned those vehicles when taking into account the definition under 1.07. I would like to get back to the evidentiary sufficiency issue on value. And Your Honor, the $46,000 and change value that was assigned by the CPA, I do think that's direct evidence of fair market value, given that it would have been unreasonable for a jury if that number reflected some other kind of value than fair market value. And I think the rational inference is it reflected fair market value because it reflected depreciation. But if it reflected some other kind of value, the jury would have to assume that the fair market value would be 35%, more than $16,000, less than that value assigned by the CPA to not meet the $30,000 threshold. And even without that $46,000 and change value from the CPA, what the jury did know was the purchase price of the vehicles. And under Texas case law, when the jury hears about the purchase price of a vehicle and then hears about the condition or age of the vehicle, the jury is able to rationally determine a fair market value based on the combination of all those factors. And I would point this court to excuse me. I would point this court to, with respect to that issue, the Johnson versus State case, 676 Southwest 2nd, 416, a Court of Criminal Appeals case from 1984 that says that what a party pays for an item reflects its fair market value. And then there's two cases that take that principle and say that when the jury learns of what a party paid for an item, meaning its fair market value at the time of purchase, and then hears about condition or age, the jury is able to infer what the fair market value is at the time of the theft. Brown versus State, 640 Southwest 2nd, 275, a Tex-Crim-App case from 1982, concerned the theft of a chainsaw and a toolbox and a hairdryer. And the evidence in that case, the question in that case was, did those items have a value, a fair market value of $200 or more? And the evidence in that case showed what they were bought for, the purchase prices. For instance, the chainsaw was bought for $115, and their age. For instance, the chainsaw was 3 months old. And the Court of Criminal Appeals held that when the jury heard about what their purchase prices were and their age, the jury was able to reasonably infer a fair market value. There's another case called Kellogg versus State. It's a 2014 decision from the San Antonio Court of Appeals, 2014 Westlaw 4230146. In that case, it involved a theft of a lawnmower and a weed eater. And there was no testimony in specifics about what the fair market value of those items was, but what there was testimony of is what they were bought for, their purchase price, and their condition. And the evidence in that case was that those items were bought collectively for, at the time of their purchase, for over $500. And then there was evidence from the owner that, for instance, he cleaned the lawnmower every time he used it. And the jury saw pictures of those items in the garage of the owner and was able to infer from the purchase price plus evidence of their condition what evidence of their fair market value was. And that's the same thing here. If the court looks at that value exhibit, the value exhibit not only gives the CPA's ultimate opinions of value at the time of the theft, but also gives the CPA opinions of, not opinions, but states the facts of what the purchase price of those items was. The newest three items, the 2016 GMC, the 2014 Toyota, and the trailer, the 2016 trailer, had a combined purchase price at the time they were bought of about $70,000. And the evidence in the record is that the GMC truck was 2 years old, and at the time it was bought for approximately $42,000. And the evidence was that the Toyota truck was 4 years old and was bought for approximately $24,000. With respect to those two trucks, the evidence on the GMC Sierra was that it was virtually new and did not have much use at all. That's from volume 3, page 24 of the record. With respect to the Toyota, the evidence was it was bought 4 years ago and it was in excellent condition. And then with respect to the trailer, the testimony was it was bought for $4,600 and change just 2 years before the theft. So when the jury had evidence of the purchase price of all three of those items plus that third truck, and then evidence of what their condition was, the virtually new and excellent condition at the time of the theft, the jury could reasonably infer a fair market value of at least $30,000. So I think the direct evidence from the CPA's opinions of value, the $46,000 and change, even if it didn't reflect a fair market value, the jury could use that number to reasonably infer a fair market value. Then the direct evidence of the purchase price plus condition and age of the items. And then finally, the circumstantial evidence of taking away the value exhibit altogether, the jury hearing that these items, the 2016 Sierra being only 2 years old and being in like new condition, the 2014 Toyota being 4 years old and being in excellent condition, a third truck and a trailer, the jury was made up of people who presumably drive or at least have some knowledge of cars. And the standard of review says that the jury can use their common sense and common knowledge to reach decisions on evidentiary sufficiency. So even taking away all of the direct evidence, the circumstantial evidence was sufficient to show, when viewed in the light most favorable to the verdict and allowing the jury to draw all reasonable inferences, was certainly sufficient to show the value of these vehicles.
Am I correct, counsel, that there weren't photographs in the record of these vehicles? We've got the video, the surveillance video, I guess, from the yard where they were driven off, but it's hard to tell what sort of condition they were in from that. Are there pictures anywhere?
I don't remember seeing pictures of them, but what we do have is Mr. Clapp's testimony about their condition, and that the newest truck was virtually new and had hardly ever been used, and the 2014 truck was in excellent condition. So I think that testimony would serve the purpose that photos would serve with respect to that. I would like to move to the jury charge issue, and the standard there is egregious harm, which the case law defines as a high and difficult standard to meet. The Villarreal case from the Court of Criminal Appeals, 453 Southwest 3rd, 429, Text Crime App 2015, says that it's a high and difficult standard, and that standard can't be met in this case, even though the jury charge did contain error by omitting the definition of value as meaning fair market value, because the jury was presumed to have applied a common definition of value that matched the statutory definition, because despite Mr. Rush's arguments today and in his briefing, the main issue at trial was not value, but was whether Mr. Rush committed the theft at all, and because the jury was properly informed during closing argument about value meaning fair market value. With respect to the last one of those first, the question that was asked today was by Chief Justice Sutterith, didn't the jury hear about fair market value being the proper standard? And the answer is yes, and that is found on page 107 of volume 4 of the reporter's record. It was not just once or twice. It was four times during the closing argument from Mr. Rush on value where he used the phrase fair market value and pointed the jury to that being the proper measure of value for them. So that part of the egregious harm analysis weighs heavily in favor of the state. The jury was correctly focused on...
Did he define fair market value in his argument? He used the phrase, but did he define it for the jury when he made the argument?
He didn't define that term, but neither does the penal code. The penal code defines value as meaning fair market value, but doesn't then go on to define what fair market value means. So the jury was correctly focused on fair market value as the proper measure. And then with respect to the issues at trial, from his voir dire to his opening statement to his questioning of the witnesses to his closing argument, the issue at trial was not principally value, but was whether he committed the theft at all. In fact, there are only 11 pages of the reporter's record that focus at all on value, and that's during the testimony of Mr. Clapp. And only three of those pages that focus on value were from Mr. Rush's cross-examination. So, and that's in volume 4 of the reporter's record. The pages that focus on value are pages 6 through 16, but pages 14 through 16 are the only pages where Mr. Rush asks any questions to any witness about value at all. So it was a very minor issue at trial, and under the Bullock case cited in the state's brief, that's a factor that weighs heavily in favor of there being no egregious harm. I don't think there would be any harm in this case from the lack of a definition, but certainly not egregious harm. And then the first one of those factors with respect to the jury charge was that the jury was presumed to apply a common definition of value. The Bullock case said that as well. It quoted the Merriam-Webster definition of value in that case, 479 Southwest 3rd, 422. And the Houston Court of Appeals said that since the dictionary definition of value means a marketable price or a fair return in goods or services, the jury would have commonly understood that that's what value meant. The current definition of value under Merriam-Webster's is the primary definition, the monetary worth of something, or the secondary definition, a fair return or equivalent in goods or services. Both of those, when the jury walks into the courtroom with that common understanding definition of value, leads to a determination that there was no egregious harm from the lack of defining that term because the jury would be presumed to have applied that very definition in its deliberations. So I think any of those three things, the common definition of value, the focus of the trial, and the correct focus on fair market value in the defense's closing argument, any of those three would be enough to weigh against a finding of egregious harm, a high and difficult standard.
With
certainly
with regard to focus, so is it your position that he mentioned fair market value? That's what keyed the jury into understanding what they were supposed to be looking for at value, but that he didn't focus on fair market value when he made that argument?
Your Honor, my position is not that value was no issue at trial, but that it was not the significant issue at trial, and neither was it during his closing argument. During the limited, narrow portion of his closing argument and when he discussed value, he used fair market value 4 times. So he did discuss value in his closing argument, but it wasn't his principal issue.
Did he argue that fair market value was not established by number three, by state's exhibit number three? So he specifically addressed number three and the fair market value issue.
That's what his argument was.
Okay.
That fair market value had not been established.
Well, and didn't defense counsel get Mr. Clapp to agree? I'm looking at page 16 of volume 4 after they go through some questions. He said, so technically you don't really know whether that number or value on exhibit 3 is accurate. And Clapp says, I do not know, sir. So there seems to be, at least in my mind, a little disconnect.
And I see my time has expired. If I could answer the court's question briefly. He did say that he was not personally aware of the accuracy of those values. But there was no objection, first of all, to the CPA's qualifications, his expertise, or any of his reliability of his numbers. That wasn't the objection to the admission of that exhibit. And secondarily, during his briefing in this appeal, the appellant doesn't argue that that exhibit is unable to establish any value or that it's incompetent in evidentiary sufficiency review. He says in his brief, the evidence established some unspecified valuation. He goes on to say on page 48, State's Exhibit 3 establishes the value of the vehicles for the accounting firm for Falls Concrete. So the argument here is that not that it's incompetent to establish value, but that it just didn't establish fair market value. And for the reasons that I've argued, I think it did fairly establish or lead to a reasonable inference of fair market value, and given the rest of the evidence, the jury could have reasonably reached that inference as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you for your time.
May it please the court. I'd like to start going back to Justice Kerr's question about remedy and the IAC claim in the motion for new trial. And as I thought about that, as I listened to opposing counsel argue, I really thought I needed to supplement that. And I need to supplement it because it is important to have an entire new motion for new trial window. And the reason that is so important is that it gives us an opportunity to draw a proper motion for new trial. It does not have to be the same issues that are just before this court now. And in fact, it almost certainly wouldn't be. It would be a comprehensive review of counsel's representation, addressing all of the deficiencies, and he would likely be called to testify. And so it would be an entirely different issue than the issue that is simply before the court today. As the court is aware, that is an essential element of a trial, and I think really is an important place. We downplay motions for a new trial in criminal cases, but I think that the role there really is important, and we see that here. Turning very quickly to the jury charge, of course, egregious harm is a high standard. We acknowledge that. Fair market value was mentioned 4 times, but value is mentioned far more times than fair market value. The fact that most of the trial was about the theft and not about the value, I think, is a red herring, and I think it's a misleading argument. Counsel for Mr. Rush didn't have any responsibility to present anything at trial. He didn't have to develop the argument about value. He didn't have to go in and make a value argument. That burden was soundly and permanently on the state during trial. So to say that Mr. Rush's counsel somehow contributed to the confusion about value by not raising it more, I think is a bit misleading. Now, Bullock is a persuasive case in some regards because it also involves a lease. But I think what distinguishes Bullock from this case and what makes it less persuasive is there just really is no question about what the value is. It was a leased truck. It was valued at $85,000. There was a lot of credentials to understand how that $85,000 came. The court went through putting the evidence into the opinion very carefully. It's really just a different sort of case. And finally, referring to my page 48, what I wrote, the values in States Exhibit 3 established the quote-unquote value of the vehicles for the accounting firm of Falls Concrete, LLC, but no rational juror could have heard the evidence and viewed States Exhibit 3 and decided that this value was the fair market value of the vehicles. So I think the second part of that is important. Now, if there are no questions, I will yield the balance of my time to the court, having said everything I think I need to.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, we appreciate your arguments today. This does conclude the only case we're hearing an oral argument today. So as soon as we adjourn, you're free to go about your business. Your case has been submitted. Thank you.
Thank you.
All rise.